WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
In 1988, a Fortune magazine poll of executives and analysts picked Herman Miller as one of the 10 most admired companies in the country. The company has been manufacturing well-designed furniture since 1923, when it was founded by D.J. Dupree. The company's best-known designers included George Nelson and Charles Eames. Its best-known product is the 1956 Eames chair. D.J. Dupree's son, Max, took over the leadership of the company in 1980 and ran it till last year. As CEO, Max managed through respect, not intimidation. He viewed the company as a community built on relationships among employees. Max Dupree describes his management style in his new book, Leadership is an Art. He tells a story about his father's early days at the company, which set the tone for its future management.
That's the story of the millwright, who in those days, in the 20s, was a crucial figure in a small manufacturing company, because that was before the days of electric motors. And so a machine room, which for instance ran saws, drill presses, that kind of thing, all kinds of equipment, was all run by a pulley system, so that every machine was run by a pulley from the main drive, and the main drive was run by the steam engine. And the steam engine was driven by the waste, burning the waste from the operation. So it was a beautiful cycle. And the person who had to make sure all of that worked was the millwright. So he was indispensable. He came before everybody did, made sure the factory was ready to run, and then stayed till after everybody left. And that was his job. And one day, he died. And my father was still a relatively young manager at the time. Didn't quite know what to do about such a situation, but decided that he should go call on the family. And he did, and he met in the living room with the widow and the children. And during the course of the visit, the widow asked if it would be okay if she read some poetry. And of course, my father said, sure. So she went to another room and came out with a bound book and sat and read for several minutes from this book, and it was beautiful poetry. And when she finished, my father said, it's really beautiful. Who wrote that? And she said, my husband did. Well, as he was walking home from that visit, he began to struggle with a question that we really struggle with even today, which is, did we have a millwright who wrote poetry, or did we have a poet who did millwright work?
What difference did it make to you in one way or another?
The difference that it made to me as I was growing up as a manager is that it explained to me in a graphic way that there's a lot more to every person we come across than is instantly visible. And that we had to understand that the people that we work with are usually deeper and have more potential than what a given job may require. Another thing that it taught me is that there's a breadth to our diversity that's very important. And if as a leader you decide that you're going to put an emphasis on reaching potential, as for instance compared to reaching goals, then you need that understanding of the uncommonness of persons.
There are 5,000 people in your company. How can you keep a sense of everybody's personal, individual nature when you're dealing with a company of that size?
Well, you work at it in two ways. One is that I think as a leader, you make a conscious decision that you're going to put an emphasis in your own life and work on relationships as compared to agendas. And the other is you try to discover ways in which you can actually be in touch in a meaningful way with as many people as possible. Can I give you an example?
Sure.
One of the things that you hear occasionally in so-called business literature is that there's such a thing as management by walking around. To me, that's only a partial answer. What we did when I was the CEO is it was required of the six people on my work team that once a month, each of us had a brown bag luncheon with at least 12 people in the company, and we could not pick the agenda. In other words, we always had to deal with agenda that was brought to the table by the employees, and the meeting had to go on for at least an hour. Well, you see, as compared, for instance, to managing by walking around, this gives people an opportunity to not only enter into a discussion with you, but to examine the discussion, which is what you have to do if you're going to have meaningful relationships.
Now, who would those 12 people be who would meet with you? Because I've noticed that a lot of corporations are very uncomfortable about people from the bottom part of the pyramid talking directly to the people at the top part of the pyramid.
Yeah, that's true. There are a lot of people in organizations who are very insecure about that. But, you see, it improves the quality of communication throughout the organization if all so-called levels are interacting together. If a middle manager knows that at some point some of her employees are going to be talking to the CEO, then she's going to be much sharper about the way in which she communicates with her group. There are some risks in that, but the advantages far outweigh the risks. And the way we did it is we allowed people to volunteer for these meetings. Nobody had to come to the meetings.
Mm-hmm. You have to make it really clear that you're not going to hold anything against someone if they say something negative to you or about you.
Yeah, that's right. That's true.
Was that ever hard for you to do?
Someone
has the guts to tell you something that they think is really wrong, either with your management style or with the company?
Yeah, sometimes it's difficult. I had an experience, which was a good experience for me, quite a few years ago when I was doing that. A young woman in the group turned to me and said, why don't you approve of babies by adoption? And I said, well, I do. She said, no, you don't. I said, well, I do. She said, you do not. And I said, well, you know, tell me more. She said, if you really approved of having babies by adoption, you would have a fringe benefit for it. But this company only pays for natural babies. And I didn't know that. And so later we got two or three of us together and talked with her further about it. And it took us about 2 weeks to change the policy so that adopted babies were also paid for by the company benefit program.
What's an example of a time when you were faced with perhaps an economic crisis where you had to do something you really didn't want to do, such as laying off workers? I don't know if that's happened to you, but if it has, I'm sure it was difficult to figure out how to do it, how to handle it.
Yeah, it happens, I think, in most companies on a kind of a cyclical basis. You do reach these points where you need to flatten management, as they say these days, or where you're overstaffed and you've been too optimistic in adding people, or orders fall off. And so you do have to have some layoffs from time to time. I think that one of the techniques that we developed for dealing with it, probably the best technique, and we don't always use it, but we use it most of the time, is we communicate with people about what's happening, and then we invite volunteers. And in many parts of the country, there are periods when people are happy to volunteer to be laid off. And we've had many times when people have said, well, you know, our family is in pretty good shape. We can take some time off. We'll let the younger people stay on. Or we've had situations where two spouses work, and one will say, "Okay," and in the interest of the whole problem, one of us will take time off for a while. So we found that the fairest and most effective way to handle some of those layoffs has been through volunteering for time off.
And that's with the understanding that there'd be a time when they would be rehired?
Well, usually with the understanding that if rehires become possible, they'd be first on the list.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. So instead of you seeming to arbitrarily make cuts, it becomes more of a cooperative decision in a way.
Yes, that's right. But now I don't want to give you the impression that we always do it so beautifully. We do make some cuts, and sometimes we make cuts in ways that we shouldn't do it, and we feel badly about that afterwards, and I hope we learn from that.
Mm-hmm.
We do have clay feet.
You've written a book on leadership. Have you ever read one of those management textbooks yourself? A textbook or one of the, you know, one of the pop books that have been in such vogue for the past few years?
Well, not for quite a few years. Quite a few years ago, I read especially Peter Drucker's things.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1980, when I became a CEO, Peter has been a consultant to Herman Miller for a good many years, and he and I have become good friends. He said to me, you know, you really ought to stop reading business books. You know how to manage a company, and you don't have much time, and you ought to just read what really appeals to you. So I must say, I haven't read any of those books for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Your book, Leadership is an Art, it's a small book in a time of very thick books.
Yeah.
And the print is looks like triple space to me.
Yeah.
Was that your idea, to leave that much space between each line?
Yes, because, you know, leadership is something that we don't know enough about. And I wanted people to be able to contribute to the book. I saw it actually as a participative book. And so, as I mentioned in the introduction, I like people both to read between the lines and write between the lines. Because what I was encouraging them to do was not only to read the book, but to own the book by finishing it. They can, and in fact, one man wrote and told me he had added 5 pages to my book, which I think is terrific.
Max Dupree is now chairman of the board of Herman Miller. His book, Leadership is an Art, is published by Doubleday.